So we're moving now in, there's a new volume over there if you want it. We're moving into the 5th century prophets. So the first 10 minutes will be introducing you to the 5th century as much as we know about it, and there's not a lot, because there's not a lot from inside the Bible about it. In fact, there's nearly nothing. And from outside, the world wasn't that interested in Judah. So we've got to work hard to get any information, but I'll give you all I've got to give you a feeling of the context within which the two prophets we're going to do tonight start. And Obadiah is one, and the second is an anonymous person who added to the Zechariah scroll that we looked at last week. So, some details. That's the little, there is the little, that's Yehud, as we've seen, the little bit of the returned Judah. And I'll read you this. A dramatic loss of population in Judah as compared to how things were at the beginning of the 6th century. That's when the Jerusalem was captured in 598, so prior to the exile. Yehud was of little economic interest to Persia, and remained economically stagnant through till the middle of the 5th century. So you need to get an impression that the prophets here are talking to a people in a very depressed state, economically and in every other way. This highlights, for me in any case, the extraordinary achievement of such a small population living in such a depressed environment. Everything being equal, it's a wonder that the Jews in Yehud didn't disintegrate and disappear, as did many of the small nations around them. No one's heard of Moabites today, or Edomites, or Ammonites, or but this group of Jews, we still hear about. So their survival is extraordinary, and it's to do with their sense of who they are. A sense of who you are, of course, is important for all of us as individuals and as communities. So they had a strong sense of their God, Yahweh, and their mission and who they were. And that's something they handed on, clearly, through the family. Second thing to say, though I've mentioned it before, is there's a change of the place of the temple in the life of the Jerusalem community. Prior to the exile, the temple was closely linked with the king's palace. The ordinary populace came to the temple only on very special occasions. You might say by invitation only. This changed after the exile. There's no king anymore, so it's not a palace chapel. It's the people's temple. And the temple functioned as Jerusalem's social and economic as well as religious centre. Local leadership in this little place called Yehud was, of course, controlled by the governor appointed by Persia. But his interest was tribute, getting money, how to get it back to the centre. His interest was trade. His interest was, let's say, foreign affairs. But when it came to the life of the people and their community life, not being a king running the place and running the state, the power really was in the hands, for the first time, of the high priest. So he was the person who looked after the cult, the religion, the law, the Torah, the whole internal religious life of the community. There's the map I've been giving you all the time of the Persian Empire. The key international factors that influenced Yehud during the 5th century were three. There was the increased power of Greece. Make a distinction between Macedonia and Greece for the moment, so there. And there was Babylon, which is here. So Babylon was, it's a big empire, so you can imagine local areas wanting to flex their muscles and find independence and so on. And the third one was the Egypt, because Egypt never liked being under anybody, and they were under the Persian Empire. So there's that's a trouble spot, Greece is the trouble spot and Babylon here. And in the middle of all those trouble spots, you have this narrow... The only way to get from here to Egypt is along there, between the desert and the Mediterranean. So that gives Jerusalem an important role as far as the Persian authorities are concerned. A couple of dates. Over here on the left-hand side of the map, you'll see some names that you grew up with as kids. We all did. Marathon, where the Greeks held out the Persians, and the bloke who ran to bring the news to Athens, whatever the distance was, that was the beginning of the marathon games. So, the Olympic Games. Up here is Thermopylae, where there was another victory. And then Salamis here was a naval victory, because the Persians really were not naval, it's all land people. But when they conquered the west coast, Ionia, it's often called, it belonged to Greece. When they conquered this party on the west coast, they picked up, because there's a shipbuilding place somewhere here. I've forgotten the name for it now. And so they got their navy, so they were able to, but they were defeated by the... So there are your dates. For 490, Persians repulsed by the Greeks at Marathon. This is the first half of the 5th century, which is our period. In 480, 10 years later, the Greeks defeated the Persian navy at the Battle of Salamis. And throughout the 80s, the destabilizing effect of the Greco-Persian wars was felt throughout the Persian Empire, including our little area of Judah. In 458, the middle of our century, Egypt, combined with the Athenian navy, conquered again the Persian. So Persia was kind of stopped. Still had a lot of land, but it couldn't go west any further. One other thing before I start the text. Judah in the 5th century, Israel, Judah, saw itself as having a special role in history's movement towards the goal determined by God. Let's see if we can get hold of this a bit. Most of the religions, Egypt, Babylon, Assyria, it was pretty normal. Most religions of the ancient world were nature religions, really. And life was circular. In fact, that's the swastika that we all know, which was, among other things, it was an Egyptian sign of peace. Can you believe it? You know, the spring, summer, autumn, winter, the constant cycle of birth and death and movement, but it's a circular movement. So history keeps repeating itself, and they have the gods of all the different ones of them. So, but that's not Judah. Judah had a, I think it was unique, but I don't know enough ancient history to say that with confidence. They had a linear idea of history. They had a sense that history was going somewhere, that their God had a purpose for them, and that there was a goal there for them to achieve. You know, Abraham, you will be a father of many nations, etc. So there's that kind of movement, which gets us to a word that you don't use every day, I don't presume, but you've probably met it, and it's the word eschatological. Eschaton in Greek means the end, the goal. So eschatology is a area of theology that's concerned with what they call the last things. For example, heaven, hell, judgment. What is the goal? Where are we going? What's the final end for which we're all created? Now, this eschatological view became especially significant in Judaism after the exile, because they've got nothing now. They've got no king. They've got no hope, really. They've got no... Economically, they're in the doldrums. So obviously they think, well, maybe there'll be something in the future for us, and we're going to see the prophets as they will talk about that. We'll also find that's a reason why there's very little current history. The earlier prophets were talking to their contemporaries about their king and about their rulers and about their judges and about what they were doing and weren't doing. You got all that? And so they were in the actual text. There's a lot of interest, and they can show you, you can get an idea of when they were speaking, because they're talking to the current community about them. These prophets aren't. It's not entirely missing, but basically they're talking about, and they had an idea of an interventionist God, which is all the way through the Old Testament. God would come and, we can't do it. We haven't got a king to do it. We haven't got an army to do it. We're not going to do it, but one day God will keep his promises and he will come into history somehow and clean it all up. And you got it, the feel of it? So that's an eschatological view. That makes it pretty hard, in fact, to date the actual prophecies, because when you read them, there's not a lot to go on, as you'll see in a moment. So now we come to our first prophet for tonight, Obadiah. The entire prophecy of Obadiah is focused on God's judgment against Edom. I'll go ahead and then I'll come back. There's two maps side by side. This is before the exile, the one on the right. And you can see that Edom is here. Judah goes right down into what's called the Negev down here. And east of the southern part of Judah is Edom. There's Moab and there's Ammon there. Ammonites, Moabites, Edomites. So Edom is basically southeast of Jerusalem and of Judah. When you look at the map after the return from exile, there's Judah. The Nabataean Arabs, the desert people, have come in and pushed the Edomites west. So where are they going to go? Well, they go into here, because there's no one to stop them during the exile period and in this slump in Judah. So they actually take over the whole southern part of what used to be claimed by Judah. So there's going to be a lot of anger, and we're going to see it in this prophecy. There's going to be a lot of ill will to these people who've come and taken their country from them at a time of their special need. And you probably need to know as a background, in the ancient legends, and that's what they are, Edom and Jacob and Esau, who's the founder of Edom, were twin brothers, you know, in the story. They came out. In fact, Esau was the older one, but Jacob had him by the ankle as they came out of their mother's womb. And then there's all that interesting story from written, of course, not from the Edomite point of view. So these are cousins, in other words. They're closely related tribal people. But Judah felt betrayed by them in 587, as we'll see in the prophecy, and they've also taken over their land. So what you're going to get here in our prophecy is a pretty angry outburst against Edom, and it's they're angry, so Yahweh's angry, because Yahweh's their God. The skirmishes that were a constant feature of the rivalry between Judah and Edom, and you find that right through the literature, well, that was one thing. Quite another, from Judah's point of view, was the unforgivable way in which the Edomites cooperated with the Babylonians in bringing about the destruction of Jerusalem and its temple in 587. They joined with the Babylonians and were used by the Babylonians in the attack. So they saw which way the wind was blowing, so they weren't going to oppose the Babylonians. They had enough sense not to do that. So they sided with them and they came in and helped with the takeover of Judah. Obadiah accuses them, and these are just quotes that we'll meet in a minute, of slaughter and violence against Judah. He blames them for not coming to Judah's aid when they could have. He blames them for gloating over the ruin of Judah, for looting and for handing over to the enemy those who escaped, tried to escape, and they captured them and took them back to the Babylonians and they got decapitated or whatever. Such sentiments could have been expressed, obviously, any time after 587. So just what I've told you so far could have been written in the 6th century. A violent oracle against Edom is included in the Jeremiah scroll, and we'll look at a bit of that tonight. Writing in the early years of the exile, Ezekiel condemns Edom for its role in the catastrophe. So everyone was aware of what Edom did, and there's a lot of reference to it in Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and now in Obadiah. However, and this makes me think that, not only me, of course, you're trying, there's different opinion among scholars, because they're all guessing a bit, haven't got enough evidence to come up with a certain thing. Obadiah confidently holds out the hope that Judah will reclaim the land occupied when Judah was unable to protect itself. And the text seems to me to come from a little bit of a distance from the event. This fits better, I think, sometime after the return of the exile, and I suggest in the early part of the 5th century, but that's just a suggestion. Let's now look at the text. There's only one chapter in Obadiah. Probably you'll be very happy that you came tonight because you've read Obadiah, and I don't imagine you'll ever read it again because there's not a lot of inspiration in it, I don't think. If you find some, tell me. But at least we've done it, and it's there, and it was kept for reasons that you can search for as you work it with me now. Here's the beginning. The vision of Obadiah. Well, Obadiah, the name has a meaning. Obed, O-B-E-D, means a servant. And I-A-H, can you see Yahweh there? A lot of those was Zedekiah, etc. It's a frequent ending, so it's Yahweh. The servant of Yahweh is the meaning of it. Obadiah is a vision. Thus says the Lord Yahweh concerning Edom. And this is what Yahweh is saying. We, capital, plural, we have heard a report from Yahweh, and a messenger has been sent among the nations. We is the divine council. They're not really monotheists yet. In fact, we probably aren't either, may I say, but anyhow, they weren't yet. So the idea of, you know, on the Olympus, you've got Zeus and you've got his council. Well, and up in Zaphon, you've got the gods of Hadad and his council, his other gods. So the Jews had the idea of a collection too. In one of the Psalms, it has the council and the divine, all the gods. And Yahweh stands up and says, look, there's not enough justice in the world. And they bow to Yahweh, and then that's in one of the Psalms. So get into that kind of mentality. Here we've got it's not the Trinity we're talking about here. It's a divine, something big up there in wherever the gods. And they've sent this messenger down, and the messenger is, rise up, let us rise against it for battle. So, okay. That's simple enough, I guess. But look at Jeremiah 49:14. I've heard tidings from Yahweh. A messenger has been sent among the nations. Gather yourselves together and come against her and rise up for battle. Mm-hmm. What you've got now in what we're moving into here, and in a moment too, is these are prophets of the book almost. The great prophets are earlier. Amos, Isaiah, Micah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel. Now we're in a post-exilic, and you've got scribes, you've got rabbis, if you want to use the word, studying the scrolls. Obviously, Obadiah is quoting, I would think, Jeremiah 49:14. Though even then you have to have a little bit of a doubt, because the fact that it's in Jeremiah's scroll doesn't mean that Jeremiah said it. It might have come later. So the two of them may be bouncing off each other. It's not even impossible that Obadiah was first and Jeremiah, the scroll bit, was second. So be aware that it's much more complicated than it might appear to you. But at least we can see different scrolls learning from each other, quoting each other. We'll see it again now. Chapter 1, verse 2 to 4. There's only one chapter, verse 2 to 4. I will surely make you least among the nations. You is Edom. God's going to get back at them. You shall be utterly despised. Your proud heart has deceived you. You that live in the clefts of the rock. Edom's quite a mountainous area. You've probably seen pictures of Petra later on, and that's in this part of the world, even though that's a Nabataean city. But, there's high mountains here. So, you that live in the clefts of the rock, whose dwelling is in the heights, you say in your heart, who will bring me down to the ground? Though you soar aloft like the eagle, though your nest is set among the stars, from there I will bring you down, says Yahweh. And in a number of the Psalms, by the way, you'll read, and I can't remember the numbers offhand, but you'll read them, they're talking about the helmet and the war and the Ammonites, but their real fear was the Edomites. Who's going to help us bring the Edomites down? Because they had this mountain fortress and they were very hard to dig out, like the Afghanistan people, Afghani, because of the mountainous areas and so on. But having read that, let me read Jeremiah 49 for you, and you'll hear it again. 49 verse 15. I will make you least among the nations, despised by humankind. The terror you inspire and the pride of your heart have deceived you. You who live in the clefts of the rock, who hold the height of the hill, although you make your nest as high as the eagles, from there I will bring you down, says Yahweh. Obvious connection between the two texts. So we're dealing more with texts now than with people going into the temple and talking from their prayer with urgency about injustice or something. There's something different happening in these prophets. And thirdly, and this is the last one of these, verses 5 to 7, which you'll see again is related to Jeremiah's scroll. If thieves came to you, Edom, if plunderers by night, how you have been destroyed. Would they not steal only what they wanted? But they've actually stolen everything. They've been wiped out. If grape gatherers came to you, would they not leave gleanings? They'd leave something behind. But look at you, Edom. Nothing's behind. The Nabataean Arabs have pushed them west out of their fortress, and they're in the Negev, Edumea. How Esau is the brother of Jacob. Esau is the founder, if you like, of Edom. How Esau has been pillaged, his treasures searched out. All your allies have deceived you. You sided with Babylon, you sided with these big ones, but they're treating you like nothing. They're not going to defend you. They have driven you to the border. Your confederates have prevailed against you. Those who ate your bread will establish a place of foreigners in your stead, in which there is no understanding. You can see why I tried to give you the background so you'd understand that. Here's Jeremiah. If grape gatherers came to you, would they not leave gleanings? If thieves came by night, even they would pillage only what they wanted. But as for me, I have stripped Esau bare. I've uncovered his hiding places. He is not able to conceal himself. His offspring are destroyed, his kinsfolk and his neighbours, and he is no more. And now, just to complete the prophecy, verse 8. On that day, here's the eschatological view. This is how things are now, but something is going to come. And I guess this is why the little chapter of Obadiah was kept, because it promised a better time. On that day, says Yahweh, I will destroy the wise out of Edom and understanding out of Mount Esau. Your warriors shall be shattered, O Teman. Teman is one of the mountains of Esau, of Edom. So that everyone from Mount Esau will be cut off for the slaughter. Why? For the slaughter and violence done to your brother Jacob. Shame shall cover you. You shall be cut off forever. on the day you stood aside, on the day that strangers carried off his wealth, strangers, the Babylonians, and foreigners entered his gates and cast lots for Jerusalem, you too were like one of them. But you should not have gloated over your brother on the day of his misfortune. You should not have rejoiced over the people of Judah on the day of their ruin. You should not have boasted on the day of distress. You should not have entered the gate of my people on the day of their calamity. You should not have joined in the gloating over Judah's disaster on the day of his calamity. You should not have looted his goods on the day of his calamity. You should not have stood at the crossings to cut off his fugitives. You should not have handed over his survivors on the day of distress. So there's the memory of the way they felt betrayed, even though they had skirmishes with their neighbours over the years. They felt totally betrayed in 587. For the day of Yahweh is near against all the nations. As you have done, it shall be done to you. Your deeds shall return on your own head. I like to think of Jesus reading this or hearing it in the synagogue. And none of it would have made sense to him. It's about revenge, isn't it? It's about an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. It's primitive. It's tribal. This is all coming from God, as Obadiah sees it, and as the people around him see it, as the whole culture sees it. So a culture can be blind too, even in the prophetic literature. And so this is so different from love your enemies, isn't it? As you have drunk on my holy mountain, all the nations around you shall drink. You drank, they're going to drink from you. They're going to drink you dry too. They shall drink and gulp down and shall be as though they'd never been. But on Mount Zion, there shall be those that escape, and it will be holy. And the house of Jacob shall take possession of those who dispossessed them. They're going to take their land back. The house of Jacob shall be a fire, and the house of Joseph a flame, and the house of Esau stubble. They're going to burn them up. They will burn them and consume them, and there'll be no survivor of the house of Esau. So far you can put up with that anger. But the end bit, for Yahweh has spoken. So this is all done in God's name. And the final bit of the chapter, and this is all there is in Obadiah, verses 19 to 21. Those of the Negev, that's the southern part where Idumea is, those of the Negev will possess Mount Esau, and those of the Shephelah. The Shephelah is the... There's a north-south mountain spine, except here before Galilee, and the Shephelah is the western slope of that mountain range, sloping down into the foothills and then finally into the sand dunes and into the Mediterranean. So that's the Shephelah. So the Negev, the people down here, they'll take over from Esau. The Shephelah, they'll take over the land of the Philistines, and they will possess the land of Ephraim and the land of Samaria, and Benjamin is here, will possess Gilead. The exiles of Israelites who are in Canaan will possess Phoenicia as far as Zarephath. I've added that to the Zarephath there, so that's north of Tyre and south of Sidon. So the people up here will move up there, so they're taking over the whole area, in other words, the whole of the promised land. And the exiles of Jerusalem who are in Sepharad, and none of the scholars know where Sepharad is, it's lost in the sands of history, but presumably it has to be somewhere down here, will possess the towns of the Negev. Those who have been saved will go up to Mount Zion to rule Mount Esau, and the kingdom will be Yahweh's.